looking at the Gemara in Shabbos on 21b. So there is no Talmud that's specifically dedicated to the holiday of Hanukkah, as opposed to Purim, which has the Talmud. There's a whole tractate called Megillah, which is talking about the Megillah of Esther. And then from there, you have a lot of discussion about Purim in general. When it comes to Hanukkah, there is no Talmudic tractate that's dedicated specifically to Hanukkah. But then it comes out in a couple of different tractates. And where you have the most of it is in the tractate of Shabbat, of Shabbos. And specifically, it comes under when the Talmud discusses the lighting of candles for Shabbos. So then, in that context, the subject matter of lighting Hanukkah candles comes up. And so I'm picking up in the middle of a discussion, the Gemara, talks about the mitzvah of Hanukkah. So it says like this, the sages taught. Now, before this, just to give you a little, you know, they were talking about one of the major discussions is what is suitable for lighting candles on Shabbos. What can you use to light your candles on Shabbos? It refers to the oils and to the wicks. That's really the discussion. And then within that discussion about the lights of lighting Shabbos candles, we come to the and here it's talking about like the time of what is the time period of lighting candles, and then it stops and gives us Breita, which is a Mishnah piece that talks about the mitzvah of Hanukkah. The sages taught it in a Breita. The basic mitzvah of Hanukkah is each day to have a light kindled by a person, the head of a household, for himself and his household. So, you know, you go buy a house, you know, especially during these days, and you see one candle in each window, you know. You see now it's not a Jewish house. So technically speaking, the mitzvah of Hanukkah lighting is not this 8, you know, or 9, you know, type of menorah, but just one light, technically speaking. The mitzvah of Hanukkah is ner ishu beita, which means one candle per household per night. Not adding, not subtracting. That was the basic mitzvah, lighting one candle. Comes along and says, and the Mahadran, those who are meticulous in performance of mitzvot, kindle a light for each and every one in the household. So the next level up would be not just one light for the entire house, but we're going to light a candle for each person in the house. And then the Mahadran and the Mahadran, who are even more meticulous, adjust the number of lights daily. Okay? So we are... Our practice is the Mahadran and the Mahadran. We take on the most meticulous performance of this mitzvah because we add and subtract. We add, because that's what we're doing. So we add, and that's going to be, we're going to see that there's a machloket, there's a dispute between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. How exactly do we approach the nights of adding or subtracting? But the idea is that we're not going to light just one candle each night. We're not going to light a candle for each person in the house. But we're actually going to take it to the Mahadran and the Mahadran. We take this and we do it the most meticulous. We take the most scrupulous way of doing it. We're going to light the candles that are going to reflect which night of the 8 days of Hanukkah it is. Now, here are the different approaches. Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel disagree as to the nature of that adjustment. Beit Shammai say, on the first day, one kindles 8 lights, and from there on, gradually decreases the number of lights until, on the last day of Hanukkah, he kindles 1 light. And Beit Hillel say, which we end up holding like Beit Hillel, they say, on the first day, one kindles 1 light, and from there on, gradually increases the number of lights until, on the last day, he kindles 8 nights. Eight lights. Okay? So now, the question is, what is the basis? So what's interesting here is what we've gone from is having a mitzvah potentially of just one candle per night, one candle every night, to maybe having a candle based on the amount of people that are in the house, to the position that we have of adding a candle each night. And that's the most meticulous way of doing it. So that there's something about the Hanukkah practice of how we've accepted upon ourselves to be the most meticulous in our observance, okay? What's interesting is, you know, every time you see a formulation, you always have to stop and say, so why is the Gemara, why is the Talmud formulating it in this way, right? Could have just said, you know, here's the deal, guys. Just light an extra candle every night. Let's be done with it. So, like, why is it giving us this, like, stages of one candle to maybe per house, per person in the house? So there's a very interesting thing that's going on here, that perhaps there is something about the idea of the house being the driver. We call it the machayev in the parlance of Talmudic categorization, which means, like, what is creating the obligation here? Is it the individual or is it the household? The way that the Gemara is formulating here, you kind of get the sense that there's something about the household that is at play as well. It's not just the individual or maybe the amount of people that are in the house, but there's something about the house that seems to be the context of the mitzvah. You know, you see the way that it's formulated here, going from one house, one light, to the amount of lights is going to reflect the amount of people that are in the actual household, to now reflecting the night of the week. Okay, so it you know, when we see this formulation, you're supposed to take pause and just realize that there's something, you know, the way they put it together gives us more of a sense of that there's something going on here that will be analyzed by those who go deeper into, like, you know, what's the driver here, that there's something about the household being a driver. It's so much so that if someone's traveling, let's say, and let's say we go on the road, our wives are at home, it's possible, actually, that the halacha says that your wife can light for you at home, and that fulfills your obligation. Which is kind of an interesting idea. So that just shows that the house, there's something about your domain that can be a driver in terms of the obligation of that is. Now the question is then what's the point? Which I saw an explanation of the idea of Pirsume Nisa, that the whole thing here is really to publicize the miracle. Like, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to publicize the miracle. And that's why, like, you see, like, Chabad, let's say, they're going out and they're making a real strong push to make this a public display. Right, right? So if I guess, if the house, if the idea is the idea of really getting out the message, then perhaps the home is more of a driver to help get us to that place than, you know, being out in the public square. I don't know. That's what we could talk about it. Okay, that's something that we could try to develop and understand better. Okay, but I want to go into this Beis Shammai Beis Hillel dispute. Why we see Beis Shammai basically says that we're going to go upwards. We're going to count from one up. Eight down. From the most down. And then Beis Hillel, which goes from the least up, right? We're going to count up, Beis Shammai counting down. So the question is why? So Ula said, there were two Amoraim in the West, Eretz Yisrael. There were two rabbis of the time of the Gemara, the Talmud, that lived in the land of Israel, who disagreed with regard to this dispute. Rabbi Yossi bar Avin and Rabbi Yossi bar Zvida. One said that the reason for Beis Shammai's opinion is that the number of lights correspond to the incoming days, i.e. the future. Incoming days. So on the first day, 8 days remain in Hanukkah. One kindles 8 lights. And on the second day, 7 days remain. One kindles 7, etc. So it's the idea of the days coming in, but it's kind of a countdown. The reason for Beis Hillel's opinion is that the number of lights corresponds to the outgoing days.
You can look at it 2 ways, because, like, you can say this is the first day, so I'm lighting one.
Right, right. It's a funny way of saying it, right? And that's what you need. Like, so each day, the number of lights corresponds to the number of the days of Hanukkah that were already observed. Okay.
Right.
And one said that the reason for Beit Shammai's opinion is that the number of lights corresponds to the bulls of the festival of Sukkot. You hear that one? What? Right? Where do we get? Where's that coming from? Okay, so that's a very interesting idea. But what he's saying is, it's very interesting. Let's see what he says. 13 were sacrificed on the first day, and each of the succeeding day, one fewer was sacrificed. Okay, so just going back, going to that, if we look at the holiday of Sukkot, there is something very different about that holiday's sacrifices compared to the other holidays. Very striking. And that is that we bring the 70 bulls. And the 70 bulls, over the course of that holiday, are to symbolize that we're actually... There's some real deep connection between the holiday of Sukkot and that of us and the nations of the world. It's a much more universal type of holiday in our how we, as a people, will look outward or we relate to the nations of the world on that holiday, and it's reflected in the bulls, these bulls that are brought, okay, and they're called the 70 bulls, and when you look at them. To cover that many in that amount of time, what's interesting is we start out with the largest amount, and then each night it goes down one. Each day, I'm sorry, because we only do the korban during the day. Each sacrifice, you see a decrease in the amount of bulls that are brought each day. So this opinion saying that Beit Shammai's model for how you're going to light the Hanukkah menorah is a countdown. You're taking the largest amount first, and then you're slowly dropping it down, which is modeled. We have a model of this from
this
the Pari, right? What?
This precedent.
Right? This precedent. And by the way, you should know that this really is a very deep idea in general, that when we approach anything, we always look for some kind of Torah source, meaning when I say Torah, the five books of Moses, we're always looking back there to find the source for modeling. So the rabbis don't just go willy-nilly, today I feel like X, Y, and Z. It's like, no, I want to look for legal precedent in not just anywhere, but I really am looking for from the five books, from the Chamisha Chamisha Torah, from the five books of Moses, I want to see there the model for how I'm going to, implement this something. So here you see this idea. And it's...
Each person was required to... sacrifice 70 bulls?
No, so this was done in the temple. This was done by it was like the communal sacrifice.
Communal numbers.
Yeah. Otherwise, it would just be. Can you imagine the price of?
Really,
Hugh, you didn't know about this? That we all have to bring these 70 bulls, and we got what a fortune that would be. Ay. Okay. All right. All right, so the idea is that would be done by the communal. The communal, that's being done in the Beit HaMikdash as a communal sacrifice. Now, that already itself, why exactly we go in that descending type of order is another discussion. And then why Beit Shammai would, according to this opinion, would tie Hanukkah to Sukkot is a very interesting, there's a lot of discussion about that. This is not, again... When you see something like this, you can't stop and say, okay, let's fly through. But there's an actual connect now between Sukkot and Hanukkah. That's what they're saying here. Okay, so it's something to think about. We're not going to dwell on it right now. Again, I'm pointing out this needs more, needs to look at that a little more. Okay, fine. Now, Beit Hillel. The reason for Beit Hillel's opinion is, that the number of lights is based on the principle one elevates to a higher level in matters of sanctity and one does not downgrade. Therefore, if the objective is to have the number of lights correspond to the number of days, there is no alternative to increasing their number with the passing of each day. Malin Bekodesh Ve'im Moridim. We always go up in terms of sanctity. We always try to grow and build on it. We don't go backwards. So it's reflecting this idea that each night we add on additional lights to show that by the eighth night we're really built up to this great thing of more light, more sanctity. Yeah. Okay. So. Yeah. Okay. So now.
There wait a minute. Yeah. Hold on a second. Why is there no precedent for that?
Well, no. So we have that idea. The idea of Malin B'Kodesh, Ve'im Moridim, we have in many places, that idea of elevating. Yeah. But that's a very, it's good, right. So, but that's, I guess it's already assumed, like he's, the way he's saying it is that, yeah, we have that, that's a legal precedent. And we have that, we find that in many places, this idea of elevating, of always building upward when it comes to sanctity. Okay. So that's, yeah, so that's an, but yeah, so, okay. But what's interesting is, I'll tell you a little, a general rule of thumb between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel and all of their disputes, and there are many. They say that the kernel of the, or the like the essence of their dispute is really about how you view things. It's from what perspective. So the general idea is that, and we see this more in other places, that Beit Shammai is looking at it more from the perspective of God, and we, as opposed to Beit Hillel, which is looking from the perspective of man. An earthly view as opposed to a heavenly view. So, in a sense, like when we look at, let's say, the creation itself, God had to pull back. God is tsimtzum. It's the idea of God's pulling inward to allow us the space to be. So God's always like going, in a sense that in God's model, if we're looking from his perspective, his relationship to the earth is always a little bit of more of a withdrawal, so you can have greater to go downwards, as opposed to Beit Hillel, which is man's idea of expansion. We're always growing, we're expanding into that space. So you see that reflected in this Hanukkah thing as well. Okay, fine. And so therefore, we always paskin, we always decide with we always position with Beit Hillel. That's the rule of thumb. Okay?
There's
Now,
nobody, there are no communities that you know of that do it the other way.
no, because the idea is that we paskin universally, we always go with Beit Shammai's opinion in this day and age. They
Shammai,
say.
wait, Shammai was the one who went from 8 down to 1.
Correct. We do one up to 8, right?
Shammai is 8 to 1 or 1 to 8?
8 to 1. His first night, he's lighting the full menorah, and then by the last night, he only has one.
You do that?
No, we do like Beit
Oh,
Hillel.
right. Okay, that's what I'm saying. Okay, that's what I'm saying. Okay.
Right, we do like Beit Hillel. We go from one up to eight, right?
Yeah, I'm asking is there anybody you know that does it the other
No,
way?
because we our halacha. If you find someone that does that, you smack him around. It's like, dude, come on, you should know better.
Okay.
So did Shammai win any of the thing? Like, is there any, or is Shammai just, oh yeah, Shammai?
No, so it's a good question. So the answer is, I mean, like literally, like 99% of the cases are always go like Beit Hillel. That is like you see that all over the Talmud, halacha is like Beit Hillel. Yes, halacha is like, I'll give you like we did that. We talked about the case of where. In Shema, right? We had that came up. Like, are you supposed to literally lie down when you say Shema at night? So Beit Shammai says that's like you have to do it that way. And we say no, you don't do it that way. So that to the point where a guy was riding along and he stopped his vehicle and got down and to lie down to say Shema at the evening, and they said, "Are you crazy? Like, what are you doing? Like, first of all, you put yourself in danger, and for what? For something that we don't do like, So, what are you doing?" So we see many, many, many places. Although there are a couple of exceptions, but 98% of it's all Beis Hillel. There are famous stories about just there. It's all over Shas, all over the Talmud. You have this thing comes up all the time. They ask the question.
I would have thought for the rare one that's won by Shammai, it would be like, no, the one time we follow Shammai is.
They say actually that, I mean, Shammai was in his, they say Shammai's approach is a little bit sharper than that of Hillel. So the question is, why then do we side with Beit Hillel all the time with Hillel? So they say that Hillel always went out of his way to put Shammai's opinion first, only to have his opinion second, to show his incredible respect. And that respect and deference he had to Shammai was, I mean, there are other, there, I think that I like the reason that the idea that Shammai and Hillel's approaches are really, you look straight, you'll look at and you'll see consistently. Hillel's is coming from the perspective of our man's perspective as opposed to God's perspective. Shammai's is from the other side. And that Therefore, in this world, they say that the times of Mashiach, in the next iteration, will go like Shammai, because we'll change our view of how it will be more of a God down as opposed to man up. So, you know, okay. Next. So here we go. So now. So then it says like this. Rabbi Barachana said that Rav Yochanan said, there were two elders in Sidon, and one of them acted in accordance with the opinion of Beit Shammai, and one of them acted in accordance with the opinion of Beit Hillel. Each provided a reason for his actions. One gave the reason for his actions, the number of lights corresponds to the bulls of the festival. And one gave the reason for his actions, the number of lights is based on the principle one elevates to a higher level in matters of sanctity, and one does not downgrade. Well, what's interesting here is that you see, even though, again, we end up saying the takeaway long-term is that we always go like the Shammai approach, which you see now universally.
The Hillel approach.
What? The Hillel approach. Did I say the Hillel approach? Always lighting upwards. And that's universal now. We all do that way. But what's interesting here is that here, when they talked about the reason, they gave the reason for Shammai is corresponding to that of the bulls of the festival of Sukkot. Not the other one, which about the days in and out, as opposed to, right? So it's like they kind of got it down to these two, that you always go up in sanctity as opposed to downward. Okay, so now that we've covered that, so next. So Hanukkah. So the sages taught in a Braita, another, again, this is on Mishnah. When we see a Braita, that's the time of the Mishnah. Even though now we're in the Talmud itself, we're bringing down these earlier texts. It is a mitzvah to place the Hanukkah lamp at the entrance to one's house on the outside so that all can see it. Again, it's a mitzvah to place the Hanukkah lamp at the entrance of one's house on the outside so that all can see it. So again, when we talked about, like I mentioned earlier, this idea of what drives the mitzvah, what drives the obligation, it seems to be this play of a person's home. And here we see that the Talmud tells us, bring down a braita, that a person should really put their Hanukkah menorah outside the entrance of their home. Because again, this is the idea of Pirsumei Nisa, to publicize the miracle. So if he lived upstairs, he places it at the window adjacent to the public domain. And in the time of danger, when the Gentiles issued decrees to prohibit kindling lights, he placed it on the table that is sufficient to fulfill his obligation. So the Talmud is telling us here, bring down the Braita, that the ultimate observance of Hanukkah lighting is to put it outside your house, to put it in your front door so that the people can see it. You want to get the message out there, right? So that's also very interesting. Again, similar to like what I mentioned earlier about the idea of Chabad, that model of getting it out there is really like what it's about, okay? And in Israel, you'll find it much more prevalent, people lighting their Hanukkah menorah outside their front door, as opposed to us, who kind of like, you know, we're the Jews of the exile, so we're still kind of when you see it, you get uncomfortable. If you see someone has a big like Hanukkah menorah outside on their lawn or something like that, it's like, oh, that's kind of right. You get that kind of a reaction. But here, you know, so we see that based on this, you know, this historical, you know, danger of drawing attention to ourselves and things like that, that it became something that by our nature, we started putting it into our window or more internally within our homes. But the idea is ultimately to put it outside, which is happening much more in the land of Israel. Okay.
So, in the old city or in Jerusalem, they have, where you go down those cobblestone pathways, some of the apartments or dwelling places have like an outdoor, something juts out of the front. And it's either like a box or a glass encasement.
That's exactly what you're seeing. Exactly. And that's what they're putting the menorah.
That's what the menorah does.
Mm-hmm. So it's very, right? So you see the development here. So now, okay. So Rava said, One must kindle another light in addition to the Chanukah lights in order to use its lights, as is prohibited to use a light of the Chanukah lights. Meaning you cannot sit down in front of a menorah and read a book, because it's not meant to be used for its light. It's meant to be used, it's there to, as a, you know, as a symbol, or something that, right, it's symbolic here. And if there is a bonfire, he need not light an additional light, as he can use the light of the bonfire. However, if he is an important person who is unaccustomed to using the light of a bonfire, even though there is a bonfire, he must kindle another light. Okay, now, so what's interesting here is, it kind of laid out, and said, so, by the way, I forgot to tell you, what's this Chanukah deal? Okay, so the Gemara asks, what is Chanukah? And why are we, are lights kindled on Chanukah? So it's very funny how the Gemara, it's almost backwards. It should have started out with this question. So many times you'll see the Gemara will start discussing something and then take pause and say, oh, by the way, let's get back to like the, you know, let's talk about what is Chanukah itself. So the Gemara answers, the sages taught in Megillat Tanit, on the 25th of Kislev, the days of Chanukah are 8. One may not eulogize on them and one may not fast on them. What is the reason? When the Greeks entered the sanctuary, they defiled all the oils that were in the sanctuary by touching them. And when the Hashmonaim monarchy overcame them and emerged victorious over them, they searched and found only one cruse of oil that was placed in the seal of the high priest, undisturbed by the Greeks. And there was sufficient oil there to light the candelabrum for only one day. A miracle occurred, and they lit the candelabrum for eight days. The next year, the sages instituted those days and made them holidays with recitation of Hallel and special thanksgiving in prayer and blessings. Okay, so let's try to get a little bit of a deeper understanding of what's going on here. Okay, so on the 25th of Kislev, the days of Chanukah are 8. Let's see the Hebrew of that. Yeah. And they're happy days. How do I define happy days? Well, a happy day is if, God forbid, someone passes away, you can't do a eulogy on that day. And you can't fast on those days. So it's saying to us, whereas normally you could give a regular eulogy, or you're allowed to fast if you had a reason to fast, on this period of time, they're happy times, and therefore you can't do those two things, which define, if you can't do that, that means it's a happy time. So now, why is it a happy time? Because when the Greeks entered the sanctuary, so they came into the Beis HaMikdash, they came into the temple, and they defiled it, and they defiled all the oils that were in the sanctuary by touching them. Now, the part touching them is he adds them. It's okay, so he's explaining to us what that means. Okay. And then when the Hashmonaim monarchy overcame them and emerged victorious over them, they searched and found only one cruse of oil that was placed with the seal of the holy priest, the high priest, undisturbed by the Greeks. Now, what's interesting here is the Hashmonaim came from the tribe of, they were actually descendants of Aaron. They were Kohanim. The fact that it calls them the monarchy is a very strange thing. Later on, historically, the Hashmonaim group ended up taking the monarchy for themselves. But at the time of Chanukah, they were not the monarchy. The question then becomes, why exactly it calls in here, Shagavra Malchut Beit Hashmonai, that the monarchy of the Beit Hashmonai, of the house of Hashmonai, of the Hashmonaim, why is it referring to them as monarchy? So I saw yesterday, Rav Tzadok Milublin, he explains that the idea of monarchy is that when you are at battle, that the nature of war, the ones who lead those out to war, are the kings, are the monarchy. So that the fact that the Hashmonaim sect, that group of Kohanim, were the ones who went out in battle, they were therefore, by default, the monarchy, even though that's not what their MO was not, they were not acting as kings at that time. But the fact that they went out to battle and represented the Jewish people as the warriors of the time, that's why they're referred to as monarchy, which is kind of an interesting... later on, they're very much criticized for the fact that they took the monarchy. But here at this time of Hanukkah, historically, that was not what they were doing. Okay, and they emerged victorious. Now the question is the nature of the situation with the oil. It's a couple questions that come up. One is, technically speaking, when you're in a case of a situation where you don't have the adequate supplies to do a mitzvah. So you're an ones. You're in a situation where you cannot you're not capable of fulfilling your mitzvah. We have a rule of thumb that if you cannot do something because it's against your it was something that was out of your control, you're not obligated to do that. So, technically speaking, they really were not obligated to light the menorah at that time because they didn't have the supplies, the proper supplies. They had one night's okay, great. So what's interesting is what then comes out of this is that the fact that there's this miracle that occurs around this lighting of the menorah is almost, in a way, God saying to us, "I really find the lighting of a menorah is a special thing." I mean,
if they knew that they're not obliged to light the menorah because they only had one oil for one day. What the hell they go ahead and light it for?
So they have the 1 day's worth. So they light it. They do that. That they do, right? They have the supplies.
Knowing that they can't fulfill it.
Right. No. So they have the 1 day deal. So they go up and they say, okay, I'm going to do 1 day. So that at least they do you have to play out what you can do. So I have supplies for 1 day. I'm going to light for 1 day. They all ask the question, if they had enough for 1 day. And then it lasts another 7 days. Why do we celebrate an 8 day holiday if the miracle is only for 7 days, not 8 days? You hear the question? Right? But
just going back, just because I think the question you was asking, they were all they were trying to do is, hey, we're supposed to have this candle lit every day. We have enough for 1 day.
Right.
Well, all right, let's light it for 1 day. There was no 8 day concept. At that point.
Correct. Correct.
Like, they weren't saying, oh, we only have a candle for 1 day. We're supposed to light it for 8.
Oh.
It was a daily obligation to light the candle. And they're like, well, what are we going to do tomorrow and the next day? And it's like, well, we'll worry about that then. Let's just light
it.
Right. So the question becomes like, so why celebrate an 8 day holiday, make it a 7 day holiday? Because the miracle ended up being the next 7 days. Until they were able to get the new supply of oil. So, right, that's one of the questions. That's a famous question that they asked. So some say that they looked at the oil after the first day and they noticed it only went down a percentage. And when they calculated, they realized it was a percentage of an eighth. So only an eighth of the oil burned off, which is pretty unbelievable, right? So that's perhaps why we look at it as an 8 day. But the bigger thing is, if you take a step back and you say, huh. So they end up having this incredible miracle where the oil lasts for 8 days when it should have only lasted for a day. So like we're saying, like, oh, wow. So it was a miracle that this small group of marauders called the Chashmonaim were able to defeat the mighty Greeks. That's a pretty big miracle. But we end up lighting a menorah, and the focus of the holiday, even though we make mention of the miracle of the military victory, but that's not, we clearly put all of our focus on that menorah lighting and the light of the menorah. And so Rav Tzadok Milblin, again, just it's like a very nice idea. He's like saying, like, notice the fact you have to take pause and realize that God is messaging and saying this idea of the menorah is very special to me. Like, I really appreciate you guys lighting the menorah, and that's why I'm accentuating them, having a miracle occur around that, right? The fact that it didn't need to have to happen, right? Here again, onus rachmana patri means that if you don't have the supplies, you're not obligated. So the fact that it's all of a sudden playing out this way, it's like saying to us, whoa, God really appreciates the lighting of the menorah. That's why he made a miracle happen around that. And then when we come to the holiday, we really stress. That becomes like a major thing that we talk about. We talk about the oil. Oil becomes like, every little like side thing of like, you eat latkes, oil. You have the sufganiyot, those jelly donuts, is because the good ones are made in oil. So it's like oil, because it's all about the oil. So like we see it's all about the light. So there's something very, the message that God was telling us is that there's something very special about the lighting of the menorah. And then going a step deeper is that what is the menorah historically meant to us is it's the light of the idea of the Torah. The idea of illumination, the Torah to us is something that gives us illumination. It gives us the ability to see things more properly, right? So Torah or the light of the Torah, the fact that God made a miracle through the lights of a menorah takes us back to this idea of, also the connection to the Torah. What's interesting is that what we have to look at what the Greeks were trying to do to us. They were really the onslaught at this time was that they were trying to break our special connection that we had with God. That here God says the Jewish people are dear to me. They're an Am HaNivcha. They're a chosen group of people, the chosen nation, because we have a special relationship with God and we're supposed to be a light onto the nations. So here coming along the Greeks, and they say, that they're oppressing us. They were not trying to physically annihilate us like the Germans, let's say, like the time of Haman, the time of Purim, which that idea of annihilation of the Jewish people physically. But here it's a different challenge. The Greek philosophy, the Greek wisdom that became very, came into our, it was like inserted into our thought processes that became a challenge to us is how do we deal with this with Greek knowledge, with Greek philosophy. It became a very big challenge. But part of what they were doing is they were saying there's nothing special or unique about the Jewish people. And really what it comes down to is what makes us unique and special is our tie to God, which is something that is expressed and is expressed, let's say, through what our Torah. The Torah is God's communication to us and gives us our ability to, connect to God and to be able to become, to see things for what they are, gives us that ability to see things properly. So here they try to break that connect. And so when we are able to overcome them physically in battle and become able to have return to the temple and be able to take control of the temple, the fact that the miracle is expressed through the menorah and its light is not a coincidence, but it's rather very communicative of God's messaging, the fact of how important that is to him. And so therefore we in turn very much so, like, we take upon ourselves, that's how we express the miracle. We light up the menorah, and then in turn also we try to, there's a real focus on that special relationship we have to the Torah and to God. But also this last line here is the next year the sages instituted those days and made them holidays with recitation of Hallel and special thanksgiving in prayer and blessing. Right? So that idea of they made these days a time of Hallel and special thanksgiving in prayer and blessing. Like, why does that become the way to express our gratitude? In Purim, we make parties. There's a whole thing about drinking and being merry, so to speak. It's a real like idea of Purim. Chanukah, we do make parties, but that's not the focal point. The focal point is the Hallel aspect, to give the thanksgiving, Hallel v'Hodah. So and part of the way the lighting of the menorah is an expression of going back to, like, we're saying here, God, you did this miracle. We're going to, show, we're gonna, our, so to speak, our practice is to do this, to show and to really publicize this incredible thing that you did for us. But then it's also to be connected to being thankful, saying thanks, like a Thanksgiving type of thing. So the question is, why is that the reaction to the Greeks, as opposed to the way we react to the Persian, to the Haman story, where we talk about, it's all about, you know, physical celebration. But why is the Hallel and why is the Thanksgiving more of the focal point of a Hanukkah? So if you go back to what I said earlier, is that the idea that the fact that the Greeks really were coming along and saying, you guys are not special, there's nothing unique to that relationship that you guys have with God. And that's, they basically were trying to break that connect and that special relationship that we have with God. So when we come to now full circle to celebrate the victory of that which we were able to overcome, so what we're really celebrating is the fact that we do have that special connection with God. And so the Hallel, and what's Hallel? Hallel is, we're reading from, just to show you, are you familiar with what Hallel is? Okay, so let me show you. Let me give you a quick. Okay, let's go to a sitter. Okay, so here is Hallel. It's coming from the Psalms. Starts at Psalm 113. Why am I not getting any English here? Okay, because there is none. All right, let's try that again. That's funny. Okay. That is funny. Yeah, maybe it's in here. That's right. Here we go. I got some English now. Okay. Check this out. There we go. Here we go. There it is. Okay. Hallel, the name especially applied to Psalms 113 to 118, is mentioned in the Talmud when Rabbi Yehuda quoted Samuel as saying, who recited this Hallel? The prophets ordained that Israel should recite Hallel when they are redeemed from misfortune as an expression of gratitude for their redemption. In time, the rabbis made the reading of Hallel obligatory on the major festivals such as Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. Since Maccabean times, Hanukkah is likewise marked by the reading of Hallel. On Purim, the reading of the Scroll of Esther takes the place of Hallel. The reading of Hallel on Rosh Chodesh is not rabbinically ordained, but a minhag, a custom which began with the Jews in Babylon in the 2nd century and has been accepted by all Israel as an obligatory service. Because it is a minor festival, the Hallel is shortened on Rosh Chodesh by omitting half of the Psalm 115 and 116. On the last 6 days of Pesach also, only half Hallel is recited to show that our joy is diminished because of the drowning of the Egyptians. Hallel is omitted in a house of mourning on Rosh Chodesh and Hanukkah. Okay? So Hallel means to praise. Hallel is to praise, right? So here is, praise God, praise you servants of Hashem, praise the name of Hashem. The name of Hashem will be blessed from now and forever. From the rising of the sun to its setting, praise, right? So it's all praise. But when you read through this, you realize that it's all about, like, it's almost like a love song to your lover, right? So here we're praising God, and if anything, what's most interesting is that Rambam, when he codifies, in his codifying of Hallel, he actually puts the laws of Hallel next to that of Hanukkah. Let me see here. Okay, so let's see here. So you see here, this is... just go through. This is the laws of by Purim. Let me get through here. Let me jump to this. Okay, so here, this is the Rambam's version of just explaining what happened during Hanukkah, during the period of the Second Temple when the Greek kings were in power. They proclaimed decrees against the Jewish people, abrogating their religion and forbidding them to study Torah or to perform the divine precepts. They laid their hands on the wealth of on their wealth and their daughters. They entered the temple and broke through it, defiling the things that were pure. The people of Israel were sorely distressed by their enemies, who oppressed them ruthlessly until the God of our fathers, to pity, saved and rescued them from the hands of the tyrants. The Hashmonaim, great priests, won victories, defeating the Syrian Greeks and saving Israel from their power. They set up a king from among the priests, and Israel's kingdom was restored for a period of more than two centuries until the destruction of the Second Temple. So then it goes on and says, now I'm reading to you from the Rambam. This is Maimonides' book of laws, right? So he says, when on the 25th of Kislev, the Jews had emerged victorious over their foes and destroyed them and re-entered the temple, where they found only one jar of pure oil, enough to be lit for only a single day, yet they used it for lighting the required set of lamps for 8 days until they managed to press olives and produce pure oil. Because of this, the sages of that generation ruled that the 8 days beginning with the 25th of Kislev should be observed as days of rejoicing and praising the Lord. Lamps are lit in the evening over the doors of the homes on each of the 8 nights so as to display the miracle. These days are called Hanukkah, when it's forbidden to lament or to fast, just as it is on the days of Purim. Lighting the lamps during the 8 days of Hanukkah is a religious duty imposed by the sages, like the reading of the Megillah on Purim. Okay, so it's very interesting how the Rambam here, Maimonides, is giving it a much more halachic, like practical, like he's explaining to you like why and how things are done, who's obligated. Anyone obligated to read the scroll is obligated to light the Hanukkah lamp. And the one who lights on the first night recites three blessings. And these are them. Blessed are you, the Lord our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with his commandments and commanded us to light the Hanukkah lamp. Who made miracles, and then the second blessing is who made miracles for our ancestors and who has kept us alive and preserved us. And that's also the Shachianu. So he's like got the three things here. He's saying, V'tzivanu l'hadlik ner shel Chanukah, who sha'asa nisim la'avotenu bayamim ha'im ha'zman hazeh, and also the Shachianu. And on the second night and onward, you just say the first two, l'hadlik ner shel Chanukah and the Shachianu. Okay? Now, he says, what's this next halacha? We complete the halal on each and every day of the 8 days of Chanukah, and before we recite the blessing, blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who sanctified us with his commandments and commanded us to complete the halal, both the individual or the community. Even though the reading of the halal is a commandment from the words of the scribes, one recites the blessing who has sanctified us with his commandments and commanded us, in the same way that we recite the blessing on the scroll or on the Erev, which are also rabbinic. For we recite a blessing over a definite commandment from their words. But we do not recite this blessing upon something from their words when its main doing is on account of a doubt. For example, we do not recite a blessing on the tithe of a Damai. Damai is when we have questionable Meiser. When you have questionable, we're not sure whether the guy took off the Trumas, the Meiser Rishon, which goes to Levite and others, and Trumas Meiser. So there, it's called Demai, so we don't make a blessing there. That's because it's a questionable thing. So why do we recite a blessing on the second day, given that the sages only ordained it because of a doubt? In order that people, so this is talking about when you have the second day of Yom Tov here in exile, as opposed to in Israel, where you keep one day of the first day of Sukkot, or the first day of Passover, right? There's a second day. We keep a second day holy. He's addressing that. So now what's interesting here is look at what he goes on. Now, this is what I was referring to, that the Rambam now, when he codifies the laws of Hallel, it's in the context of Hanukkah. And it's not only the halal of Hanukkah that is from the words of the scribes, but rather the reading of halal is always from the words of the scribes on all the days in which we complete the halal. And it is a commandment to complete the halal on 18 days in the year. And these are them. The 8 days of the festival of Sukkot, 8 days of Hanukkah, the first day of Passover, and the first day and the day of Shavuot. But there is no halal on Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur because they are days of repentance, awe, and fear, not days of excessive joy. And they did not ordain halal on Purim because the scroll of Esther that is read on it is the halal. So the whole like idea of halal, the laws of halal, are coming in the context of Hanukkah. The question is why? It's and the Rambam is so careful. Maimonides is so careful. Everything that he does, the way he set up his law book of the Yada Chazaka, everything is put in a certain order. There are volumes of people discussing why Rambam will codify things and put things in a certain order. Specific. He's very exact about his order. So why put the laws of Halal in and Hanukkah? Why not put on Sukkot or the other holidays? Because the essence of this holiday is the idea of halal. It is halal. The idea of Hanukkah is that we're celebrating the fact that we have a special connection with God. One of the main pushes of the Greeks was to say you do not have that special. There's nothing special about your relationship. And when we're able to overcome them in that period, What we do in reaction is we're celebrating that relationship. We sing hallel. It's all about like having that love affair connect with God, that we're praising Him, and the nature of that reconnect is to praise, to reestablish that special connection that we have with God. It's like whereas during the time of Passover, Sukkot, like those two holidays really are celebrations of us coming out of Egypt and becoming God's people for the first time. Hanukkah is the first holiday where we celebrate the fact that someone tried to come and uproot that special relationship and we're not successful and we're able to overcome that. And so we really then go back to that. We go back, and that's why I think the Rambam is codifying Halal here as opposed to other places, because this is really accentuating our special relationship with God. And so Halal is an expression of that. And so it's Hanukkah that becomes the time when we say Halal more than, and a whole Halal, even more than Passover. Passover, we only say the first 2 days, we say the whole Halal. We say a Halal on the other days, but it's not a full Halal. On Hanukkah, the whole 8 days, we say a full Halal. And I think that's like you have this boat back and forth. We're reacting to the fact that God, He expresses the miracle by letting the light, the candles go miraculously, as if to say, guys, I really care about you. I care about the fact. I care the lighting of the candles means something to me. So of all the ways I'm going to express my miracle and communicate to you, it's through the medium of the candelabra, through the light, through this, which goes again. We go back and we look at what did that mean in the temple. There was no need for light. God does not need light. He doesn't need us to light to put the lights on, so to speak. But that light is more of a symbolic thing of the idea of what we said, the Torah. This idea of that connection that we have. It's like the same thing today. Even when you light the candles on Shabbos. It used to be, it's true, that the candles of Shabbos were just to bring light into the home, but it's become more symbolic of that special illumination. It's like a deeper type of light. The rabbis talk about the fact that it takes us back to the Or HaGanah, the hidden light, that the light of the beginning of creation was the light of being able to see things for their essence, and so that we go back to this again. We light these small little, it's not like this major, we're not putting up strobe lights and flashing lights. It's like a simple light. But in that simplicity, the purity of that light is what we're trying to get to, is the essence of truth, of clarity, and also that special connection that we have with God. And when we put that light on, which just bringing us back to the fact that we have that special connection. And then the outgrowth of that is we light these lights we're still here lighting those lights, and that we're saying that challah, which again really underlines and accentuates that special relationship that we have with Hashem, and it's our way of our kind of love song back to God, because we were able to overcome. Like when we were tested, Hanukkah is a time when we were tested. This relationship was tested, and we were definitely challenged by a lot of what the Greeks brought at us in terms of the first time, really in our history, of really having a very serious, you know, foe that has true wisdom that could potentially, like, you know, put our Torah at question, which we still deal with today. And anytime we're challenged and put to the test, when we overcome that test, it makes it that much greater and sweeter. And so that's what Hanukkah is. It put our relationship to test. And then when we come through it, we might be limping a little bit. Like Yaakov, after he fights with the angel of Esav, he's limping. But at the end, it says that the sun rose the next day and shined. It shined. And so this is this idea of Hanukkah, is that we go back and we light these candles. And we also, it's this challah thing. I think it's a very, it really is like the key to like what we're trying to, it's really a very special time for us to really connect to God. And to stop and to, like, you know, you read the challah and it's English. It's Psalms, again, 113 through 118, and it's just beautiful. It's really like you just go through it slowly. It's just, you know, a lot of really just going back to our special relationship that we have with God. And it talks about, like, for example, yeah, the other nations, they mock us. Where's your God? You don't see your God. What kind of God is that you can't see, you know? So, like, this issue that even till today, it's like, you know, that's the most difficult thing, is to be able to connect. You know, like, the idea of Christianity is that, in a way, the reason they're so connected with Jesus is because it's so much easier to connect to that physical, you know, type of thing. But that's exactly the point, is we don't have that physical manifestation, because our God is so unlimited that you cannot make it into a man. That's exactly where the Torah bangs the table and says, there is no such thing as idol worship. Idol worship means there's no physical manifestation of God in this world. That's exactly the point, is our God is unlimited and has no, you know, when you say unlimited, it means no limitation, no physical manifestation. And it's challenging to connect to that. But if you really, if we allow ourselves to work towards that, you're able to really connect. And you look at a challah, the words of challah, you understand it's really a beautiful, you know, expression of our ability to praise and connect to God. And that's what Hanukkah is. Hanukkah is that type of holiday. And that's why the Rambam puts the laws of Halal specifically in Hanukkah, the laws of Hanukkah, because that's what the holiday is about. It's really about this special, really reconnecting to God in this way. So God willing, it's coming soon. And that it should be, and the joy that comes from that connect is really very, very deep and very special. Any questions?
No, it's good.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good to see you guys.
Good seeing you.
Hold on a second. Let me stop the screen share.
There you go.
Hold on a second.